Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee will come to order. Thank you for being here today. We're going to start with a work session on Senate Bill 401. And we have an amendment. Phil Donovan, would you like to come up?
No, it's not. It's Senator Courtney and Senator Winter.
Oh, Courtney and Winter.
Uh-huh.
Are they here?
Yeah, Sasha up here.
Sasha, I'm sorry. Wrong bill. Sasha, come up. Sorry about that. Tell us about the bill, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 401 was originally heard on February 25th, and it directs the Department of Human Services to develop and implement a plan to increase the availability of supervision and treatment in the underserved regions for those individuals conditionally released by the Psychiatric Security Review Board. A biennial report of the department's implementation plan is required, and there is a sunset provision of January 2nd, 2016. As you noted, there is a dash one amendment, and the amendment redirects the Department of Human Services report to the presiding officers for assignment to the appropriate committee rather than automatic assignment to the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Morissette, member of the committee, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. I'm just here to answer any questions. I don't have anything to add to the bill. I just wanted to make sure that you had all the information you needed
okay.
on this bill.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Seeing no questions. Thank you. Okay. Do we have a motion?
I move Senate Bill 401 to the floor with an
amendment.
I'm sorry. I'm moving the amendment dash one to Senate Bill 401.
Thanks. Did we talk about the amendment?
We did, Senator. I just mentioned, but I'll refresh. The amendment redirects the Department of Human Services report to the presiding officers for assignment to the appropriate committee rather than the automatic assignment to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, Senator Telfer moved the amendment. Are those dash ones?
It is the dash
one amendment to Senate Bill 401. Discussion? Opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Now the bill itself.
Now I'll move Senate Bill 401
as
to the
amended.
Floor as amended with a do pass.
Okay, Senator Telfer moves Senate Bill 401 as amendment to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Would you call the roll, please? This is an important bill. We have to go on record here.
Monsanto?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Delta?
Aye.
Cruz?
Excused. Aye.
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 401 passes with a do pass recommendation to the floor, and Senator Courtney, no? Senator Courtney and Senator Winters will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to skip over SM1 because the proponents are not quite ready, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 327, and there is an amendment, and Phil Donovan will speak to that amendment. We will not move the bill. I don't think.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan, here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. With me is Dr. Rick Marinelli, my resident expert on these matters. If I could, I'd just like to quickly provide a little background, a little bit of history, and then quickly describe the Dash 1 amendment. So.
Okay.
As you know, naturopathic physicians have broad prescribing authority. They have access to families of medications for schedules 2 through 5. The only medications that are not available to naturopathic physicians are those that are synthetically derived. But all medications, before they're available to a naturopathic physician, is screened by a naturopathic formulary council. And naturopaths have a good record of prescribing medications. Just as a reminder, they get a doctoral degree, which includes 72 hours of required coursework in pharmacology. They do clinical training of over 1,500 hours working supervised with patients. And they're the only profession that has a continuing education, an annual continuing education requirement for work with pharmaceuticals. Thanks to Senator Manus Anderson, we convened a work group a couple of weeks ago. You all had received a letter that had been signed on to in opposition to Senate Bill 327 that had some different groups that were listed on. All of those groups were invited to the work group. Only the osteopathic physicians and the Oregon Medical Association were in attendance at the meeting. And we had, a good discussion. They laid out some of the areas that they agreed. They laid out areas that they disagreed. And the document that I just shared with you all is something of a synopsis of kind of the areas of agreement and disagreement and a little bit of a point, counterpoint for your consideration. And frankly, we realize that some of the issue areas probably could only be dealt with through compromise. And as such, the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians offered a compromise on Senate Bill 327 that you see encapsulated in the Dash 1 amendments. The compromise would allow synthetic medications to be added to the naturopathic formulary on a case-by-case basis, and otherwise you would continue to operate the formulary how they've been operating since 1989. We think that this gets at the primary concerns that were raised in our work group conversation. We heard concerns raised about new drugs coming on the market and immediately becoming available for prescribing authority of naturopathic physicians. But now, under the amendment, any new drug that was to come onto the market would have to first be considered and approved by the Naturopathic Formulary Council. Each drug, in other words, would have to be considered on a case-by-case basis. We heard concerns about consumer confusion about MDs, DOs, and NDs beginning to look too much alike. Frankly, the compromise that we've offered ensures that I think very little will change in the public eye as it relates to naturopathic physicians, but important primary care medications would be available to make sure that you've got effective, safe, and affordable health care. The other thing that we shared with you in relationship to the Dash 1 amendments is some new letters from community clinics, some medical doctors, a pharmacist that express the need to see change for us to address this issue of synthetic versus naturally derived. Fundamentally, we believe that naturopathic physicians have the education, training, skills, and professional ethics to implement Senate Bill 327 as it's originally drafted, but we feel like the compromise offered in the Dash 1 amendments is a meaningful step forward and addresses the primary concerns that were raised. And so we respectfully request that you adopt the Dash 1 amendments, and Dr. Martinelli would be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Manus Anderson.
Thank you. I think it needs to go on the record. Dr. Page, who's a family physician at the Outside In Medical Clinic, wrote a specific letter that saying supporting 327. She's a physician there and she also is working with naturopathic physicians and finds it very frustrating for her in working with them that she always has to leave her patient to go make a prescription on someone that she hasn't seen. She's in favor of this bill. The other one is Dr. Perkins, another family physician, and these are family physicians that are, again, supporting the prescription authority for naturopathic physicians. Another one is the executive director of the Coalition of Community Health Clinics. And this is clinics is a network of 13 private nonprofit community health clinics serving low-income and uninsured. They provide naturopathic physicians in their clinics as well as physicians, and wants to see this change. It will make them a lot easier. And then there's a pharmacist from the Lloyd Center Pharmacy who's in, and also Kaiser Permanente. Dr. Carty from Kaiser Permanente wrote and said, please expand the prescription authority for naturopathic physicians. So there are a lot of physicians. These are just a few that we just received since the public hearing that we had before. So that's what I wanted to get on record. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Senator Verger.
Yes, I want to compliment you on the compromise. I know that it was not what you wanted in the very beginning, but it certainly did satisfy me quite a bit more than the original bill as it came. I guess that I want to just go back to your comments about not seeing the differences between the doctors. I don't think there's any doubt about the education and the training. What I think that you have provided in the past was a restrained use of prescription drugs, which to me segregated you from doctors that overprescribe and that don't follow my philosophy of good health. And so I have to just put on the record that I hope that you won't keep moving forward in the direction of the whole world and stay different, because your differences are very complementary to many of us who believe in the natural way to good health. So having those comments, thank you again for the compromise.
Thank you, Senator Berger.
Senator Coons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too am grateful. I know an inclusive formulary may be a bit more cumbersome on the front end, but I think long term it's a better way to go. And with that, Mr. Chair, I know we're not moving the bill today, but I would like to move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 327 just so we have it in the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Coons moves the Dash 1 amendments to 327. Further discussion? Objection, seeing none, so moved. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 327.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 654, perhaps the most important bill we will hear this session.
What?
Yes, it is.
Would you distribute these, please?
Yeah. No, but I mean, did he say?
We do see a lot of Senator Moore set bills in this committee, don't we? That's
nice. Yes, you heard the narrative and thought, ooh, what bill is that? This came from the hospital.
Yeah, I probably do.
They don't think it should be required.
Do you want me
not allow us to
the bill? Yeah, Jennifer, would you give us
Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, Senate Bill 654 requires healthcare facilities employing a minimum of 25 employees to offer annual influenza vaccinations at no cost to the licensed healthcare employees.
Okay, Chair, committee members, I have the gavel. I could close the public hearing and adjourn, couldn't I?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Senator Morissette, would you like to testify on this?
I would very much like to testify, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. this is a bill that I think is long overdue. It's kind of like the tsunami bill I introduced in 01, and people thought I was crazy for introducing a tsunami bill. The lodging industry was very much opposed to it on the coast. They thought it would be bad for business. The mayor of Gold Beach got a chainsaw and cut down the sign in Gold Beach because he said, he was quoting the Oregonian as saying, well, gee, it looks like we're saying, come to Gold Beach, it's a great place to die. But over time, people understood the need for that kind of preparation. And the teachable moment was when the 9.2 earthquake occurred in Indonesia, and we realized that that same thing could occur here at any time. Schools are being moved. Exercises are being done in Seaside and other places. This is a, maybe you could consider this as a pandemic preparedness bill. The world is growing very quickly in population. The undeveloped world is growing even faster. There have been concerns about bird flu, avian flu. We heard a lot about the great pandemic in 1917. And I attended a meeting in Portland when Leavitt, the director of Health and Human Services, was out talking about how do we prepare for a pandemic. And I don't know that this, well, I think there's a relationship here, and the relationship is that the people who provide health services often are not, do not get their flu vaccine. They don't. Now, there are a lot of reasons why people don't want to get a flu vaccine. Hospitals offer it, as a matter of course, but people say, no, I'm sorry, I just don't think I want one. I'm tougher than that, and I don't have to have a flu vaccine. I have some handouts that I would like to just kind of go through. I'm not going to go through them in detail because hopefully we will have this hearing again. The first one is information for healthcare professionals, vaccinating healthcare workers. Vaccination of healthcare workers has been shown to reduce influenza infection and absenteeism among healthcare workers, prevent mortality in their patients, result in financial savings for sponsoring health institutions. Influenza vaccine coverage in the United States, however, remains low. Now, on this first page, you will see the organizations that support this: American Association of Physician Assistants, College of Physicians, American Medical Association, American Nurses Association. I thought I would emphasize that. American Society of Health, and so on and so on. There's a lot of support for this. On page 2, at the very top of the page, the best way to prevent transmission of influenza to those persons we serve is to mandate vaccination for healthcare workers. The list below represents just some of the champions who have taken the lead on mandating healthcare worker vaccination against influenza. And the number of states are listed: Alabama, Arkansas, California, Kentucky, and so on. On the next page, page 3 of 4, toolkits and other materials developed and distributed by the United States by state and national organizations. It has a whole list of organizations that have developed kits that can be used. On page 4, U.S. News, Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, developed a toolkit for DHS staff to use in promoting healthcare professional influenza vaccination as part of their effort to achieve a healthy people 2010 objective of 60% vaccination coverage of all healthcare professionals. Packet 2. First, do no harm. Protect patients by making sure all staff receive your yearly influenza vaccine. And here it talks about, healthcare employees are not the only are not only strongly encouraging the increase of their employees' immunization, in some instances, their organization's accreditation depends on it. That's interesting. So that's the way we're moving. Now, the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, published recommendations for healthcare settings, and the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, JACO, has established influenza infection control standards. The next packet is, I've marked it number 3, importance of influenza vaccine for healthcare professionals. With the annual influenza season underway, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, is urging healthcare organizations to ensure that influenza vaccination programs are available for healthcare personnel. And then it goes on to talk about this third paragraph, despite benefits of immunization, it estimates that 44% of the nation's healthcare workers, that only 44% are vaccinated. Down at the bottom, second paragraph, in the bottom, one hospital evaluated the impact of vaccination on healthcare personnel and hospital patients and saw an increase of immunization coverage from 4% to 67% over 12 flu seasons. Despite that time frame, laboratory confirmed influenza cases among workers decreased 42 to 9%. In addition, hospital acquired influenza cases decreased by 32% to zero. So during the time frame, laboratory confirmed influenza cases decreased as the number of people vaccinated went up from 4 to 76. The number decreased from 42 to 9 and from 32 to 0. So it does show, you know, the old adage is if you want to get sick, go to the hospital. You can pick up almost anything there. Number 4, APIC. I had a hard time. Nowhere in here did it say what that stood for, so I had to look it up on Google, and it stands for the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology. So this organization has been working very hard to promote this. Influenza is a serious disease that is associated with high rates of morbidity and mortality. In the United States, it is estimated that from 5 to 15% of the population are affected each year, resulting in approximately 220,000 hospital admissions and 36,000 deaths, and so on. And it does recognize the need. Third paragraph talks about the CDC and prevention. So this has been an effort. Page 2, there are a number of bullet points. The very bottom in the bold HCP refers to all medical and non-medical personnel in contact with patients. The CDC holds this view, including non-enumerated and or temporary staff, as well as persons exposed to human samples. The definition includes diverse roles with varying degrees of exposure with patients, physicians, nurses, even religious workers. Cleaning, kitchen, and so on should be receive the vaccine. Last but not least is the form that CD puts out. And what this form does is it doesn't force people to get the flu vaccine. Okay, my employer affiliated facility, you write your name, has healthcare facility has recommended that I receive the influenza vaccine in order to protect myself and patients I serve. I acknowledge that I am aware of the following facts, and then it gives the following facts, which I will not read. Despite these facts, I choose to decline influenza vaccine right now. I understand that I may change my mind at any time and accept the influenza vaccine if the vaccine is available. And I have read and fully understand the information. And then they sign it, and that's it. They don't have to take the vaccine. So this is not forcing people to do it. And these are licensed healthcare professionals in the bill. It says line 28 means an individual licensed by, so that, you know, is still fairly narrow in scope. There are many unlicensed people who do work with elderly, but this is a start, and it is a narrow in scope. And I've heard over and over that, yeah, the hospitals want their workers to be vaccinated, but the workers don't have to, and that's the end of the discussion. There's no gentle persuasion. This is gentle persuasion. So with that, I will stop and answer questions.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. while the bill is mandatory, there is that opt-out.
Yes.
Does that open up any liability issues for the licensed individual that chooses not to get the vaccine?
That's an interesting question. I suppose it could, depending upon the circumstances. If there was a, I suppose it could. If a person read this and signed it and said, "No, I'm sorry, I don't want the vaccine," and later was responsible and held accountable for spreading the infection, that might be a liability. Yeah, that's part of the gentle persuasion. No, it does do that, but I think that it does give people, there are a variety of reasons why people do not want to have something put in their body. I mean, every time we come up with a new vaccine for something, you know, there are those who just simply say, "No, I don't want that," for whatever reason. And this respects that right to privacy. I guess it's a right to privacy in terms of one's body. But there is also a counterbalance to patient safety and patient protection. And so somewhere in there has to be a decision made.
Senator Longstanding.
I'm one of those who has extreme reaction to flu vaccine. So I'm one of those. But it's in the bill, it says that you just have to sign a paper that you're not going to do it. But
well, and I think there might be mitigating circumstances for not doing it. As you say, I mean, there could be, which would mitigate liability. Have you had the flu lately?
No. Oh, don't say that. Now I'm going to get it. I'm one of the few that haven't gotten it in this building.
Halls that, and sitting in various places that have had the flu. So.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Morissette, where are the hospitals on this bill?
They're going to be coming up.
Yeah, they're...
Are they going to be testifying today?
Yeah.
All right.
Hospitals have recommended this to their staff, but they don't... That's as far as it goes. But there are hospitals that do recommend it. And the Hospital Association the National Association recommends it. So... Okay.
Any other questions? I should have restricted him to 2 minutes, but I didn't. So
went to great pains to make these and number them just so everyone would.
Thank you.
But,
yours are in color.
Yours is colored, and ours is black and white. I put that out. So
thank you very much.
Okay. Kathleen Bradley.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health and the Public Health Division, and I'm here to provide testimony today on this bill. What I'd like to do is provide a a brief background on influenza and then a little bit about the impact here in Oregon and then some of what our program is currently doing. You know, as Senator Morris had, you know, articulated and provided certainly a lot of information for you all, you know, flu is what actually affects one out of every five Americans. It also is an extremely significant disease for our elderly or chronically ill. We do have an estimated 36,000 that die annually in the United States, and among them we have probably about 450 Oregonians that are adversely really affected by the flu vaccine. During the last flu season of 07-08, we actually had 86 children in the United States that died from influenza-related complications. So this is a very significant concern. While most of us sort of deal with this as an adverse event in our lives briefly, for the chronically ill or for the very young, it really is a very high level of concern for us. What's important, I think, and what I wanted to point out at the top of the second page on the back page of the testimony are what the requirements are from ACIP about annual flu vaccinations. Today, it is recommended that children between the ages of 6 months and 18 years are vaccinated, people over 50 years of age, pregnant women and new parents, people with chronic medical conditions, people who live or work in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, and then people who live with or care for people at high risk of complications and healthcare workers. So that's the full set of categories of what we are recommending. Certainly with the Public Health Department, we're doing a tremendous amount of work in terms of flu vaccine education around that, supporting in an institutional level the need for flu vaccine. We do have an identification of the five different inactivated flu vaccines that are available on the market, as well as one active flu vaccine. You all have been through the last couple of years with us. You know there are years when we have lots of flu vaccine and other years when we don't. Currently, we're doing well, and we manufacturing production of it actually is beginning to smooth out better at a national level, and so we're anticipating we might be able to not have to go through the shortages and the experiences we've had within the last couple of years. For Oregon specifically, in 2007, a little over 73% of Oregon adults age 65 and older reported that they had received their immunizations. What we're concerned about at a national level, and we don't yet have Oregon statistics, is that a little over 40% of healthcare workers are covered with vaccine. And this disparity has been of great concern. Clearly, they're the ones that are most in contact with folks that are more vulnerable, both in hospitals and long-term care and other chronic care settings. And it is an agenda we're really trying to work on. About 2 years ago, our immunization program started, had an extensive discussion about this and decided that what they would start doing is starting to have conversations with different community members, with some of the different associations, to really begin to talk about what are examples of best practices. How do we really move this forward in a more concentrated way? And where we're moving towards is we'd like to develop a needs assessment, identify some interventions, and also start to work on some pilots. We've got great examples of many of our institutions that actually do offer flu vaccine, but we've got a really significant concern in long-term care settings and some of the other settings that this has been more of an issue, I think, economically and has not been as available. So I'm available for your questions. We recognize this is a significant public health issue and are interested in trying to work with our community and trying to improve our overall rates. Thank you.
Yes, Senator.
Did we have or are we in the midst of a lot of flu in Oregon this year?
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, we are. It looks like we are beginning to decrease our flu season. We've had over the last month a pretty significant impact of it across our community. Yes.
And follow up. And are you once we know what kind of flu is coming around, you figure out what strain? Do these various influenza vaccines are they good for certain strains of virus, or are they all for one kind of flu virus, influenza virus.
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, you know, they do a prediction about a year in advance about the way flu is sort of moving and what they anticipate will be the strains that are most likely to occur. And those are what are incorporated then into the vaccine each year. And there are usually two predominant strains, I believe, that usually are selected. And so we have years when it works better or worse. We're doing fairly well. I don't have the technical detail as well. I should have probably bought Dr. Paul Cieslak with me, and he could have given you the specifics, but we can provide that in writing to you.
Well, it'd be interesting to know what the cost of each of these flu vaccines are and if they're all against the same type of virus. I was just curious.
So, Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, on average, the cost is $15, I'm not sure whether all vaccines cover the same. I believe so, but again, I'll make sure that we respond back to you,
thank you,
later this week.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would just like to make a comment. I noticed that in your testimony, you talk about people who have chronic medical conditions or seriously mm-hmm. ill. When my husband was so very seriously ill, they insisted that he take the vaccine. He had a very severe reaction and was extremely ill from it. It was almost cruel for someone as ill as he was. So I wonder if there shouldn't be some determination about who takes the vaccine as to how often they're out in the public. Would you like to comment on that?
Senator Morissette and Senator Verger, our effort is actually more on the care providers than the individuals, although it works both ways. But we've really begun to shift our focus increasingly to try and work quite often with the care providers that come in contact, because quite often if you have someone who is chronically ill or has some limitations, they may be more housebound. They may have fewer exposures to the larger community, and yet their husband, their wife, their children are the ones that are actually out and coming in and out of the house and have more exposure. So there has been an increasing effort, I think, to work with the care providers. That said, you know, I think in any way possible, we try and look at finding ways to protect people. And I think it is a fairly common medical practice now that for anyone who does have chronic illness, that the recommendation of their provider is they get an annual flu vaccine, unless they've had an adverse reaction, and then that's a different consideration.
Okay. I noticed that you, when you signed up, you said you were neutral on this bill. And yet you, in your testimony, you quoted on the top of page 2 what you thought was, you know, the need for healthcare workers to have the vaccine. I don't understand it. Don't you support this bill? Does your department support this bill? I'm going to put you under oath.
Chair Morissette, we do support the intent of this bill. There's absolutely no question about this. This is a very significant public health concern. We are a little concerned about a mandate that we might have to implicitly end up being responsible for having to record or dictate and the financial implications. We also generally work hard in our community to try and work trying to educate and campaign people. So I think that is where some of our concern is. The other one is it is just for licensed providers. And when you look at places like long-term care facilities, that is predominantly medical assistance. And so I think that's why we're sort of coming to a neutral place.
We could amend the bill.
Thank you.
There are some providers in the room who I'm sure would support being included. Thank you.
I have one more question. Okay, if we have a short supply, is that a concern then? If we have a short supply of vaccine and then we have this mandate, what is the implications for the state on that? It says, the employer shall provide the vaccination and you do not, and they will provide it at no cost, but you were not able to get the vaccine.
So, Chair Morissette and Senator Monsanto, that's an excellent question, and it is one of the concerns. We do have the ability within the Public Health Department, thanks to rules the legislature has passed, to actually declare an emergency, and in that case, to set the priorities and the direction in which that would go. And so in the case of a situation where we did not feel that the highest priority, perhaps, was for healthcare workers to be vaccinated, we could set that aside or set different sets of priorities. So we can address that in rule and have been advised by General Counsel that that's possible.
And I hate to call it a mandate because it isn't a mandate. It's simply saying that people have a choice to say no, and and it should be offered. And if offered, they will pay for it. The facility will pay for it.
It is a mandate.
It's a mandate
because they have to provide the vaccination.
It's a mandate, Senator. I'm sorry.
Well, okay. What you do is it's a risk benefit issue. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a risk benefit, and I think that there, you know, it better to have a person vaccinated than to have an infected person die because that carrier was not vaccinated. So anyway, it's a good mandate. How's that?
I'm not sure I agree with that, but
okay. Thank you very much. Others wishing to testify? Gwen and Dayton and Rob Johnson. You want to sign up, right?
Yes.
With permission of the chair, I'll go first. For the record, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm the executive VP and general counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill. I want to say initially, yes, we are in opposition to the bill. We're not in any way in opposition to the intent of the bill or any of the testimony that we've heard. We fully support vaccination of healthcare providers. In fact, hospitals offer the vaccine to providers. So nothing in this bill, frankly, would, in that respect, change what we already do. So you're probably thinking, well, then why do we oppose the bill? Well, here's why we're not in support of the bill. This is a mandate on hospitals that they provide annually this vaccine to all licensed, employed healthcare providers, which, first of all, is not the entire universe of those who provide care in our facilities. And it really removes any flexibility in how we do that. And I understand that in a declaration of public health emergency, potentially there can be some prioritization, but short of that, there is no ability for a hospital to manage how it uses a vaccine, perhaps focusing on the most those who care for the most vulnerable populations first, that sort of thing. It's a mandate. And I understand that part of the concern and that might lead to this bill is that providers aren't necessarily accepting it. They're saying, no, well, this bill would continue to allow them to do that. The only change is we would have to collect a piece of paper that says that they've declined it and presumably keep that piece of paper, otherwise there's no point in doing it. So annually we're just going to be accumulating these this documentation from providers that they've elected not to receive the vaccine. Frankly, we just don't think that is the best way to achieve the goal of all of those who are in support of the bill. We are fully committed to working with the department on what really would accomplish fuller, more complete vaccination of providers. If that's education, we are very willing to participate in that. Whatever that might be, we share the same goal. We just don't think this bill necessarily gets us there and actually just imposes a difficult mandate on providers and additional burdens on them that don't advance the cause.
Okay.
So repeating myself now, but we will put on the record our commitment to working on this issue. We just don't think this bill advances it.
But you're doing it for economic reasons. From what I hear is that you're doing it because you would have to provide the vaccine free, you would have to record the papers, and you would have to do that, so you're placing your economic reasons above the health of your patients who you're serving.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, certainly not.
We
pay for the vaccine already. That's not going to change.
Did you see the form, that the education form? Did you see that?
Chair Morissette, I've not seen that.
Okay.
That is also not mandated in the bill.
Yeah.
So,
well, what's mandated is that patients or workers in your hospital license be offered this piece of paper to read the compelling reasons why they should have the vaccine, and then if they say, no, I choose not to have the vaccine, then you don't have to worry about it.
Well, Chair Morissette, I must respectfully disagree. The bill allows somebody to decline, as well it should, because as Senator Montesantis has indicated, some people don't do well with the vaccine. But it in fact doesn't mandate that particular form, nor do I believe the bill gives the department the ability to mandate that, because the bill doesn't place this mandate within the purview of the department. It's a standalone statute, not placing it within anybody's.
Would you like to offer an amendment?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, that would not be our intent, because we believe that we are already doing what this bill asks us to do, and so the bill is not necessary.
Okay. Well, according to the CDC and many, many, many national organizations, what is going on right now is not working, so they are coming out with another program that would give people an opportunity to actually read why they should have the vaccine, and then they can decline.
And Chairman said, if you'd like us to consider using that form as we implement the vaccine program in our hospitals, we're very glad to talk with you about that.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rob Johnson here representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a nonprofit trade association of licensed long-term care providers in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 654. I would start by saying that I think our members work very diligently on a consistent basis to assure that all residents and staff in their facilities are vaccinated at the highest rate possible.
Now, excuse me, are they covered by this bill?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, all of our facilities, and as the representative from
Tell me who is licensed and who is not in your facility.
In terms of, Mr. Chair, in terms of employees?
Yeah. Would be covered by the bill.
Who would be covered by the bill would be any licensed staff. So a licensed nurse, a licensed practical nurse, registered nurses. The bill would not require the vaccine to be provided to many of the direct care workers, certified nurses aides, and the like, but it does cover registered nurses, licensed nursing staff.
So would you like to offer an amendment to include them?
Mr. Chair, no, that would not be our intention.
Oh, I thought you were here because it didn't include all of the people that work in these facilities.
No, Mr. Chair, that's not why I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I am here, however, to give you an idea of what standard practice in our facilities is, which hopefully will shed some light on why we don't think that the bill is necessary. Just to give you an idea of what standard practice is in our facilities, Medicare residents are required by CMS to be vaccinated, so they are always vaccinated. And most facilities vaccinate, if not all, then nearly all of their residents well beyond those CMS guidelines. And for obvious reasons, it's in the facility's best interest to have all the residents vaccinated, not only for the safety of the residents themselves, but also for the safety of the staff. Most facilities also offer their staff these vaccines free of charge, and I've received quite a large amount of anecdotal information from our membership this week indicating that not only do they offer vaccines to their staff, but many of them actually partner with their local county health departments to conduct vaccine clinics in their facilities to make the vaccines easily available to their employees. And the ones who don't go quite that far are endeavoring to provide a great deal of information to their employees about the availability of the vaccine, whether that be posting on bulletin boards, posting in their staff lunchrooms, or actually sending information home with their employees in the envelopes with their paychecks. And as I said before, I think our concern is not about the implications of vaccinating folks in our facilities, which we've been engaged in and are committed to and have been for years. I would say that the conversation about the flu in long-term care facilities and in hospitals, for that matter, didn't start with the introduction of this bill. It's been going on for many years, and many groups are already focusing their efforts on public and private education and information initiatives to help lower the incidence of influenza and increase the use of vaccines in healthcare facilities generally. Just a couple of examples: the Oregon Adult Immunization Coalition, there's a yearly Oregon Flu Summit that's coordinated through the Public Health Division, and I just spoke with the long-term care representative from the Healthcare Facility Acquired Infections Committee yesterday who indicated to me that at their last meeting, they are starting to have conversations about this very topic as well. So as you can see, there are many groups and organizations committed to maximizing the use of the flu vaccine and reduce the danger of influenza presented to residents of healthcare facilities and healthcare facility staff. I think if there's a problem that exists as far as influenza is concerned, it's that many healthcare workers are actually declining to get the flu vaccine, and not that the flu vaccine is not available to them. In fact, just anecdotally, all of the information that I've received from our membership this week indicates that basically all of our membership, or the vast majority, are in fact offering free flu vaccines to their employees. But one of the other things that I heard from the long-term care representative on the healthcare acquired infection committee was that sometimes up to half of the employees that are offered these free vaccines actually decline for one reason or another. And so I think if we're looking to solve the problem that exists, maybe a better route would be to work through those organizations that are already working to promote the use of these vaccines by healthcare workers rather than mandating something that's basically already happening. So to close, I would just say that I think it's the position of OHCA that the best determiner of how to utilize these flu vaccines in long-term care facilities in order to maintain the safety of our residents and staff is, in fact, the facilities themselves. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Oh. And then...
Gwen, did you say you were an attorney?
Yes.
Okay. Then, and I'm not going to hold you to this, but I have a question that involves two legal issues. One is, and you may have heard my comments before, regarding the liability exposure of a licensed healthcare individual who declines to get the shot, mm-hmm. even though the bill allows that, and then the fact that this bill also excludes, as a free vaccination and requirement, a lot of people who work in these healthcare facilities. What's the liability exposure of the facility as well as the licensed healthcare individual who may fall into this bill?
Senator Morissette, or Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, I think there is additional liability for both the providers and the facilities under, frankly, not only this bill, but also just offering vaccinations generally. I think under this bill, a provider who declines will sign a written form saying, I decline, particularly if it's a form that lays out all the risks of declining. That provider would face additional liability if, in fact, one of his or her patients is infected with the flu. I think the facility faces additional exposure, frankly, under this bill, which mandates us to provide the flu vaccine only to employed licensed providers, but not necessarily to others who also have equal contact with patients. If we provide it to some and not to others, and then it's documented or somehow... there's a finding that this patient was infected by somebody we didn't offer the vaccine to, I think we're exposed on that level.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanders.
Do the hospitals track the number of people who contract, maybe there's no way to do this, influenza or have influenza in the hospitals?
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanders, I'm not sure, and I'm glad to follow up. My sense is probably not. We're in the midst of reporting infections, as Rob indicated, the new program, but flu is not one of those right now. But I can certainly ask and follow up with you.
And the other is, has the Safety Commission taken this on at all?
Chair Morissette, Senator Montes-Anderson, not to my knowledge, no.
Okay, thank you. But what was follow-up. What was the organization that you said was starting to look at this?
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, it was the Healthcare Facility Acquired Infection Committee, which was a group that grew out of a bill from the 2007 session.
And Senator Mona Sanderson, if I can add to that, that is the infection program that both the long-term care or OHCA and the Hospital Association signed on to last session that is currently focusing on a certain world of infections, but are certainly open to considering others, and it sounds like this might be one of them.
Okay, you say that the hospital would be at risk if only if some people were required to at least read this and sign it and others were not. But it just seems to me that any healthcare facility who really, really, really cared about the health of their patients would make this available to all employees, regardless of whether or not it's required. I mean, if there is a piece of paper that has compelling reasons why they should sign and it is not made available, then that would be a that would be where the liability would be. If you have this in your hand and you only give it to the people who are required in the bill and don't give it to others, so
Chairman, I do believe we're offering it to all individuals.
Are you offering a compelling reason why they should do it, is what I'm asking. Are you telling people you're concerned about having lots of pieces of paper to deal with, but here is a sheet that if someone reads this, influenza vaccination is recommended for me and all healthcare workers to prevent influenza disease and its complications, including death. Ooh, that's pretty compelling. I mean, if I could cause someone's death, then wow. If I contact influenza, I will shed the virus for 24 to 48 hours before influenza symptoms appear. Okay, that's interesting, because you could have it and not know it, and that's when you would be spreading it. My shedding the virus can spread influenza infection to patients in this facility. That's something that is a very concrete statement that people should understand. And I guess if I were thinking about that, I'd say, well, yeah, maybe I should get my flu vaccine. Because, see, I think it's one thing to offer it and another thing to make sure that people understand why they should have it. So.
Well, Chair Moore said, I don't believe we're offering a form like that to people when we offer the vaccine.
I will make this form available.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And Chair Moore said, if I might, I think certainly in the long-term care facilities, and I'm not sure about the hospitals, but certainly in long-term care facilities, I know that that's one piece of what we do in offering the flu vaccines. And in fact, not a single email anecdotally from our membership that I received this week didn't indicate that there was some sort of public information component to what they're doing. So not only are they offering these vaccines to their employees free of charge, but they're also trying to disseminate information that highlights the importance of getting the vaccine as well.
Okay. And other questions, concerns? Okay. Thank you very much. Others wishing to testify? So with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill. What are we on? 654. Okay, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 693. Yes, 693. Okay, would you tell us about 693?
Senate Bill 693, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, exempts those practicing bone work therapy from the massage therapy regulations.
Okay.
Okay. We need to call her?
Well, she's on her way.
Okay.
Okay, Cindy Robert. Well, no, let's wait a minute here. Okay, Carol Stratton, Andrea Wiener, would you come up, please? And Patty Fullerton? Pratia Fullerton. Yeah, we'll start with the proponents of the bill.
Good morning, Chair
Morissette
and members of the committee. My name is Pratiti Fullerton. I live in Deer Island, and I have a business in St. Helens. I'm a professional bone work practitioner and an instructor.
Excuse me. Deer Island is Oregon. In the Columbia River, right?
Yeah, it's very close to it, north of St. Helens.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm here today to tell you why I support Bill 693 and why I actually asked Senator Johnson to sponsor it.
Mm-hmm.
I was a massage therapist for 10 years from the mid-80s till 1996 when I found Bowen work and I learned it. And that's been the only modality I've used in my healing practice since then. Bowen work is quite different from massage. It has been in the United States only since 1986, so not very many people have learned about it. But it has very significant differences, namely, we don't do any of the same strokes that they teach you in school, in massage school, for example, effleurage, petrissage, all the different massage things that you learn in school. We have a very different type of movement that we do. Massage is generally done on the whole body with a person who is either completely or mostly disrobed. We do very, very gentle rolling movements over very specific areas, only certain points in the body, and our clients do not have to take their clothes off. We also are not in the room the whole time because we, in one of our, the parts of our system is that we are doing these very gentle movements for the purpose of rebalancing the central nervous system so that the body can heal itself. So we are actually just putting in signals into the body and allowing the nervous system to process those signals, which takes a couple minutes. So we leave the room at that time. So we're more out of the room than we're in the room. Whereas massage, you're actually taught to always keep contact with your client. The other difference is that massage has many contraindications for people with certain chronic illnesses where they can't have massage, but it's very safe for anyone to have Bowen work because it's a non-invasive, very gentle therapy. And this goes from tiny infants to frail, people who are ill, athletes, people who have just been injured in, say, sporting events or things like that. We also have our own standards and own national and worldwide organizations that regulate our practitioners. We go to our own school. We have 112 hours of just learning the basic core procedures. We have a two-day rigorous practical test where you have to show the instructor every single procedure and move that you've learned. We have written tests throughout the course. Before Bowen work practitioners are certified by our national and international boards, they have to have 100 hours of anatomy and physiology training, which they can either get with us or outside of our system. And they have to have current CPR certification. And I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that I do have a couple charts. One is the differences and one is our standards. And they also have to take continuing education, 32 hours of continuing education every 2 years. 8 of those hours every 2 years has to be to go back and practice the basic work that they learned in the beginning. And they have to keep up that continuing education and their CPR training in order to stay certified with us. We have our own code of ethics also that's on one of these pages, so that is part of our training code of ethics. Now, the reason I don't believe, besides it being so different from massage and being so safe to receive, there's not been one reported case that I know of, and I've been doing it 13 years, have been with many teachers, including the heads of the academy, the Worldwide Academy and the United States Academy. We have heard of one instance where anybody has been injured by Bowen work. Generally, body works are pretty safe, but Bowen work is very non-invasive, and people would not, if you had a massage and then you went and had a session from us, you would not be able to mistake the two. They're not, they don't even feel the same to the person. The other reason I believe that it should not be regulated by the massage board is because not only do we have our own standards, but this is like double regulation, and the cost is prohibitive once you go through all of our training and then you have to become licensed. In my case, when I moved to Oregon, I was shocked to realize I had to get licensed as a massage therapist to do this, because I had been doing this work for a long time in California. And so I did not want to put off my dream of opening a clinic, and I said, okay, I'm going to go to massage school just so I can get my business started right away, because I really wanted to continue doing my work. It helped so many people. I spent $10,000 on massage school. I had to take 200 hours of, four semesters of massage classes doing massage movements, which I will never do in my practice. I will never practice one day of massage in Oregon.
No, excuse me. Tell us about California and other states.
Okay. California does not regulate Bowen work. California doesn't, when I was there, it was by city or county where you got licensed for certain things. And massage therapists, there was all different regulations for massage therapists. Some cities didn't regulate, some did. But Bowen work was not under those regulations where I lived.
Are you aware of other states?
Yes,
other
in
states
Arizona
too?
And in Texas and in Maryland. Maryland, it's specifically exempted from the massage rules. And in California, it's not regulated. And I believe there's a couple other states that, where it's not regulated, but I don't know what they are right now.
I'm sorry for interrupting your train of thought.
I have a question, too, yeah. Since we're interrupting. If there's a complaint against someone who does bone work, whether it's cleanliness or just inappropriate conduct or obviously under the influence of drugs, etc., where do the complaints go to then? If it's not a regulatory board, where would those complaints go to?
Okay, Chair Morris, Senator Ramones Anderson, that's a great question. They would go to our National Bowen Work Academy USA. It has its own executive board, president, and the instructor group who oversee all the students and practitioners, and they would hear about that, and the practitioner would be contacted, and we would, you know, obviously find out what's going on, and if the complaint turned out to be true, they would not be able to be certified by us anymore, because they do agree, we do ask them to pledge to this code of ethics when they are a student, and they have to comply with this code of ethics as students and practitioners.
And just one other follow.
Yes.
And how much does it cost to be licensed each year? Dues each year, every 2 years?
Chair Morrison.
To maintain your massage, your license, your therapist's license.
Massage therapist license or Bowen work?
Both.
Oh, okay. Senator Morissette and Monis Anderson, it for the massage license, I'm running a blank. It's $50, I believe, and it's for us, it's $75 annual dues. And then there's, you know, the cost of the continuing education classes and the cost. They also have to maintain their massage continuing education.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. So not only does right now in Oregon somebody is required to pay $10,000 to $16,000 to go to massage school, and one of the other things I wanted to point out that myself and a lot of people I know, a couple people who whose testimonies I brought that couldn't be here today, we've injured ourselves in massage school. When I was in my early 20s, that was a different story. When I went again in my mid-40s, after doing this very gentle treatment for several years, my wrists actually could not take the pressure of the massage, and I was injured and almost was not able to start my business before it even started. And again, very little that I learned in the massage school is going to apply to what I do. I'm the second instructor who has come to Oregon. The first instructor, Alexia Monroe, whose testimony is in this, she was here for a long time. She was a resident of Oregon and was a licensed massage therapist and also became a Bowen Work instructor and has been now for about 13 years. Well, she was constantly had the same problem I'm having, is that people who want to come to our classes say, well, do I have to be a massage therapist or licensed? And we have to say yes, and then it is very discouraging for them. Especially if, you know, they want to help people, they want to do Bowen work, they know they don't want to do massage, they know they don't want to do any other type of body work, and yet they cannot afford to or don't want to pay all this money to go to massage school. So that puts a burden on us also, wanting to be able to teach this, is that we have a very limited amount of people that we can teach it to that can actually go out and use it as a career. I do have a couple students who will take it just to treat their family and friends, but that, you know, that's a lot of money for somebody to want to do that just to treat their family and friends. So,
tell us about the treatment.
The treatment.
What do you do?
Yes, okay. The treatment is... very much like a lot of treatments, in the sense that you'll come in and the practitioner will take a health intake to see what's going on with you, to have all the information so that they know what the client's condition is. And then we explain about what we do. It's a gentle treatment where I just take my fingers and thumbs and do very gentle rolling movements over a muscle or a tendon, very specific kind of movement. And this kind of movement actually creates a nerve signal that goes up to the brain, and the brain can process that, and it allows the body to reset the central nervous system so that its own healing process can begin. So the treatment is like you get onto a table. You can wear loose clothing, or I can actually work on someone in a chair, in a wheelchair, in a hospital bed, standing up. I've worked in people in all kinds of conditions and positions. I will come into the room. I'll start my sequence of little moves, and then I will leave the room for 2 minutes. This allows the brain to process those signals I have just put in to the body. I come back, I see how the client's doing. If they're, you know, resting comfortably, I do some more, and then I go out. And this can go on for 20 minutes to an hour. We don't have a set time because it is very individualized to what that person's body needs. I may have a person that can only take two of these movements before they start. Really, their body really starts processing the work, and I know that I need to let them process that for the next week and not touch them anymore. They'll get the best result that way. And then I have other people that can take a whole hour of work and they'll get the best result that way. This was exactly how Mr. Tom Bowen, who created this system, did it also. It was very individualized by people. We also do not treat more than once a week because this works in the body for 5 to 10 days, and we don't want to interrupt it with more work because they'll get a better result if we let whatever the body's natural processes happen. So we're not trying to go in there and massage away tension.
Senator Johnson, would you come up, please?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you can go ahead and finish, and then I'll. Senator Johnson has other things that she has to attend to. But go ahead and finish your, and then we'll come back to you in just a minute.
One other huge difference between massage and Bowen work is we are not trying to massage out tension in a muscle or get rid of a spasm or do this or create circulation. What we are trying to do is allow the body to do its own natural processes in its own time. It's much more gentle on the system because we are not trying to do something. So in that case, if I pick the wrong muscle to massage and they don't feel good afterwards, that's because I did the wrong thing. But when I do my Bowen Work session, the body does what it needs to do. And it's a very natural process. It's much more the way that the body normally heals, is it does it in its own time, in its own way, in its own order of priorities.
Okay. Thank you. We'll come back in just a minute. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there a microphone there?
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Bill Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. And I'm really here before you again with my argument about square pegs in round holes. I think the reason that many of these modalities are here, whether it's Bowen Work, Feldenkrais, reflexology, polarity, have to do with the regulatory relationship with the Board of Massage Therapists. And in my view, and I've expressed this before this committee before, the overreaching of the Board of Massage Therapy. Here's a situation where a small business person, an allied healthcare practitioner, went to the effort to go ahead and get the massage license at a cost of $10,000, which she'll never, according to her testimony, put into application. And I really think that this is a situation of this committee or some subset of the legislature trying to figure out how do we accommodate these healing modalities without the overbearing regulatory presence of the Board of Massage Therapists. And that's the message that I bring to you today. I think that there is a reason why Feldenkrais, Bowen Works, Reflexology, Polarity are asking for some relief from a regulatory structure that not only separates them from the people that come seeking their healing services, but also creates a legal liability for the practitioners. And so that really is my plea. I am concerned still about Senate Bill 146, which continues to expand the scope of the Board of Massage Therapy. I'm here as an advocate for these folks, whether it's Reflexology or Bowen Works, many of whom are attempting to run small businesses, have the opportunity to bring their healing arts to people seeking out their services. I think that a clear distinction can be made between massage therapy per se and the requirements there in terms of undress, in terms of physical contact, and these lighter healing arts that in many cases don't require any degree of undress at all. I don't know how big the problem is that we are trying to solve. I don't know the scope of the complaints of Bowen Works. I don't know the scope of complaints from reflexology. The only side of this that I hear, because it appears I have a concentration of practitioners in my district, is the chafing under the Board of Massage Therapy in order to teach and to practice the alternative medical arts that these folks have undertaken. So I really am here to renew my request that this committee take a look at the scope of jurisdiction of the Board of Massage Therapy and, if possible, cut these guys loose, see if the record reflects a spate of complaints. If none exist, then let them flourish outside of the strictures of the Board of Massage Therapy. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
You made a comment about increased cost or liability.
Well, my concern is that it has been my experience, specifically with reflexology, that in a regulatory environment where the board is really out looking for reasons to exert sanctions against practitioners, that kind of liability, and perhaps I use the word overly broadly, these folks don't want to be subject to fines. They don't want to be subject to actions before the Board of Massage Therapy. It's that definition of liability that I was using, and I should have been more precise.
Well, what about the other definition of liability? Don't they have some liability as practitioners of a health service that is not regulated by the state or even recognized by the state?
Well, I would presume that if their activities, let's follow Senator Monis Anderson's example, unwanted touching, depending on the degree of the unwanted touching, there are criminal sanctions against that. It appears that most of these modalities have some kind of national board that requires adherence to a code of ethics, provides for some complaint mechanism that then sanctions could be delivered at the national level. I simply don't know the scope of the problem that we're trying to correct. I don't know if there is a huge dossier on complaints from Bowen workers. I'm going to submit common sense suggests to me no, that the only experience that I've had with the Bowen Works or with reflexology is the heavy hand of the Board of Massage Therapists looking for reasons to bust people. And I think in a time when we're trying to encourage a look at alternative medicine, there are all sorts of attempts to welcome some of these practices into a fully comprehensive universe of healing arts, that we would want to encourage small business practitioners who are bringing relief to their patients. If I believe that there was a huge backlog of complaints, I would find it much more difficult to sit before you and ask for some regulatory relief. But my argument here is that I think there is a relationship between all of these folks asking to be relieved from the regulatory architecture of the Board of Massage Therapy and the actions of the board. And so, again, my plea to you would be take a look at seeing if there is a way to free these folks up, and if a backlog of complaints immediately exists, we have other legislative sessions to take remedial action. But I don't think that there is that huge pent-up number of people who are aggrieved at the activities of reflexologists or Bowen workers or Feldenkrais or any of the other modalities.
Now, were you aware of the other modalities to last session when you were talking about reflexology? Were you aware of these?
I was aware of Feldenkrais only because I knew a couple of elderly ladies that were friends of mine, mm-hmm. who absolutely swore that that was the key to their increased mobility as the effects of advanced age took over. So I was aware of Feldenkrais. I became aware of Bowen Works by virtue of the fact that there's a practitioner in my district.
Is there something about your district that attracts?
Absolutely. We are in touch with our inner soul.
Oh.
Looking for opportunities to bring healing relief to people that seek out these alternative practitioners.
Oh, okay. Deer Island is kind of the new
That's exactly
Pacific.
Correct. That is the center of the energy.
I call it the belly button of your district.
Mr. Chair, do you remember how many reflexologists there were?
A handful for the principal reason that while there was pent-up demand for instruction, there was angst on the part of the instructors that if they taught students that the heavy hand of the Board of Massage Therapy would land on them. And I think you have just heard testimony.
But I want to know number.
Oh, I can
and
find
I need,
out numbers.
Yeah, and I wanted to know numbers of Bowen Works. And
we have about a dozen.
A dozen? Okay. Compared to how many massage therapists?
I've just had assistance from the crowd. Reflexology, number of practitioners, 451. Polarity, 136. Bowen, 25. And then this is a list of two pages of all kinds of practices, many of which I'm unfamiliar with, but there are a paucity of practitioners. Conversely, when you go to Swedish massage, deep tissue massage, there are 5,000 of those, 3,100 respectively.
Okay.
But there are a paucity of practitioners, and again, I would go back to my original thesis that there's a paucity of practitioners because of the heavy hand of the board and the possibility of regulatory sanction if these healing arts are taught to others.
And you will find out about the ones that you're not familiar with.
Absolutely.
They will come to you.
Three pages of them, and half of them I can't pronounce.
And you will be back.
I will be back. Thank you. I'm going to excuse myself and go back to my committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee.
Go ahead and continue.
Chair Morrissey, members of the committee, the other thing I want to point out about taking the massage board practical test and the written test that is required is that it is all about massage, nothing about Bowen work, and I have difficulty with someone saying I am actually certified to do my work when I'm not even being tested on it. I'm tested on it by the Bowen Work Academy USA, and they can certify it because they know what it is, but there was not one question in the massage test or in the practical about what I actually do. Thank you. We also have a practitioner here who could not be here today who had a thriving practice in Arizona for 3 years, and she moved here. She's a single mother. She moved here with her small children so they could be close to her family, and she can no longer practice. She had to go out and get a minimum wage job because she can't afford to go to massage school, and it galls her quite a bit to because she knows how well she could be doing for her family if she could do what she loves and have her practice here. But
is that Alexium?
No, that is Crystal Swanson, who's later on. And actually, four of these out of these six testimonies that are written, and one of them is Carol's here, but four of us are already licensed massage therapists just so we could do our work. And one person isn't, or two people aren't. So I think that's really all I have to say on that. And I'd be happy to take questions. I want to thank you for allowing me the time to speak about what I do and this bill.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mayor Boucher.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Carol Stratton, and I want to thank you very much that for enabling me to feel a little less nervous now than when I first walked in the room. I've never been to such a meeting before, so thank you for giving me the chance to speak to you. I come to you as a student of Bowen Work. I live near Gaston, and I'm simply very excited to be able to learn this modality with which I can help and benefit others. For quite a number of years, probably 7 or 8, I have been looking for something that I could help other people with and have a lot of satisfaction in doing it myself for the remainder of my working life. I like to interact with people and I like to help their quality of life. I feel that Bowen Work is very good for my personality, my abilities, and my goals in life. I've always been able to easily talk to people about their health, and I feel like Bowen Work would give me a way in which I could tangibly impact without much force their life for the better. But there's only one thing that stands in the way of me being able to do that right now. And that is the regulation in Oregon that requires me to have massage therapy training and the regulation involved with that. I like massage. I like to receive a massage, and I respect massage therapists. But I realize that Bowen Work can speak to a lot of people where other modalities will not. For example, I have had the privilege of working on a 13-month-old baby all the way through to an 84-year-old lady who's very frail. And that's given me great satisfaction to be able to do that. It also speaks to those folks who have a fear of touch, either because they just don't like being touched or because they have so much pain in their body that they just can't stand anything that is heavier. I think you would agree that I have a very good teacher, and she has explained to you exactly what Bowen Work is and how we do it. And also about the training that I would have to go through if I could practice Bowen Work at this point in time in Oregon. Financially, it is prohibitive for me. And also, I know that my wrist could not take it, so I can't take the risk of really injuring my arms and wrists. I feel that the authorities in Bowen Work really do regulate us very well. I'm the kind of person that once I start something, I'd like to go gung-ho at it and finish it. And Pratidia said, no, you're going to have to wait quite a few months before you can do the next module of training after the initial certification. So they really hold us back so that we we've become very practiced and very skilled in this therapy. I have taken 5 out of 6 modules of Bowen Work training, and I intend to fulfill all the requirements for full accreditation in Bowen Work. I will take the anatomy and physiology and the business requirements and the CPR and everything like that. So I will go all the way to full certification. And I'm looking forward, actually, to taking continuing education to maintain the certification. I'd just like to tell you for a moment why I even thought about doing this. My husband was injured in a car accident over 30 years ago. 4 other people died in that accident. He was the only one that survived, and he has had back pain ever since. And so for me, if I can help him, it's worth taking this training. And also our daughter, she is a very avid supporter of this work. She just loves it. But as I've been practicing on people, I've realized how much I can help others if I can continue to do it as a work and as a practice. And the people that I've worked on so far, many of them don't have the funds to go to many practitioners of other modalities. So as I look towards hopefully making a practice out of this, I would like to try and help those kinds of people who do not have very many funds to do many things. And I would like to contribute to the economy of Oregon too. So I'm going to continue my training, and I have faith and trust that the legislature here in 2009 will exempt me from oversight by the massage board so that I can indeed practice this work. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your time and for hearing my concerns and goals. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
So you haven't had you don't intend to take the massage license?
Well, no, I don't think I could financially, and I don't think physically my arms would take
okay.
it.
Okay.
So I would just then have to help family and friends, you know.
Okay.
Otherwise.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to have to move along. We have another bill. Also, Andrea, is she? Yeah. Would you come up? Yeah, and Deborah? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and then we have one more after you guys, so if we could. And then we have another bill. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Chairman Morissette and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm Andrea Wiener. I live at 830 Southeast Selwood Boulevard in Portland, and I'm the assistant director of the Feldenkrais Guild of North America, and I'm here today representing the Feldenkrais Guild of North America. I'm also a guild-certified Feldenkrais practitioner with over 1,000 hours of training since 1987, and I also have 1,000 hours of training in massage therapy. And I was licensed in San Diego from 1982 to 98. I have multiple sclerosis, and I rely on the Feldenkrais method of somatic education to maintain my mobility. The Feldenkrais Guild of North America is a nonprofit professional association of Feldenkrais practitioners incorporated and headquartered in Oregon. We set professional standards, we accredit training programs, and certify practitioners. We have over 1,500 certified practitioners and members residing in the U.S. and Canada, and 42 in Oregon. And we were first incorporated in 1977 in California. It's necessary to be certified in order to practice the Feldenkrais method in the U.S. and Canada because the Feldenkrais Guild owns the registered service marks, Feldenkrais, Feldenkrais method, and others that are used by Feldenkrais practitioners.
Would you wait just a moment, please?
Yes.
We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 717 while we're at it, as long as that's what you're testifying.
For both.
You're testifying for both, and we'll hear them both together because we don't have time to do them.
Okay.
So as long as you're testifying, continue.
Thank you. The Feldenkrais Guild of North America supports Senate Bills 693 and 717 because these exemptions would prevent inappropriate regulation of these professions, which are not massage. We also support an amendment to one or of the bills to provide a similar exemption to prevent inappropriate regulation of the Feldenkrais method of somatic education. And that proposed amendment would add language with the same format as is already exists for reflexology and is being proposed for polarity and Bowen work, that practitioners of the Feldenkrais, to exempt practitioners of the Feldenkrais method of somatic education who do not claim expressly or implicitly to be massage therapists and who limit their work to the practice of the Feldenkrais method of somatic education through the use of words, directed movement, and limited touch to deepen awareness of existing habits and new possibilities of movement. Feldenkrais practitioners should be exempted from the massage statutes because the Feldenkrais method is a method of somatic education and is not massage. Many lessons do not involve touch, and the intent of the touch is educational. The students remain clothed. Our profession is self-regulating through our service marks. We have an ethics and grievance protocol, and that protocol includes referring to board of directors where people can lose their certification and ability to practice.
While you're pausing briefly, what's the difference between the two?
Between
bone work and... They sound like they're similar.
You know, I learned a lot about Bowen work this morning, and I still know very little about it. Not enough to say.
What is your treatment like?
Looking at this, if you pull out the brochure that's in front of you, it shows you people working. And like if you look on the, open it up all the way and look at the picture on the inside upper left corner, there's a woman sitting and a woman standing.
Yeah.
And that woman standing is using her hands to guide the person sitting, to guide her attention to how she's using her spine in doing a movement of rounding her back. So the hands are here to bring attention to different parts of the body so people can feel what they are doing and what they can do differently. And we do it in many different situations, many different applications. So you see here, sitting, standing, lying down. And in all kinds of situations, we work with people who are Olympic athletes, symphony performers. San Francisco Symphony has Feldenkrais practitioners on staff. Anything that we do as humans, including sitting on our butts all day, involves movement. And the Feldenkrais method is geared towards doing whatever we do more effectively. Does that answer your question?
Kind of.
Kind of, yeah. We have two kinds of lessons. One is called functional integration, and those are the hands-on lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is called awareness through movement. So you're seeing people in classes. So we teach those. Those are guided through. So some of the work we do is guided through words, and some is guided through touch and movement.
Now, you're a practitioner.
I am.
Are you a massage therapist?
No, I'm not a licensed. I was, I lived in, when I was practicing massage, I lived in California. And from 1982 to 98, I was licensed there. They didn't have a state license, but they had in San Diego a city license, and I was exempt from having to be fingerprinted and go through the vice squad because I had 1,000 hours of training there. So, more questions? Okay. Where did I leave off? Okay, we support the bills because the exemption would prevent inappropriate regulation. And the language would suggest adding language to exempt practitioners of the Feldenkrais method of somatic education who do not claim expressly or implicitly to be massage therapists and who limit their work to the practice of the Feldenkrais method of somatic education through the use of words, directed movement, and limited touch to deepen awareness of existing habits and new possibilities of movement. And we feel that the Feldenkrais practitioners should be exempt from the massage statutes because the Feldenkrais method is a method of somatic education. It's not massage. Many lessons do not involve touch, and the intent of touch is educational. Students remain clothed. Our profession is self-regulating through our service marks. There have been problematics of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy, including disseminating incorrect information, having improper contact with practitioners of other professions who are not practicing massage, and making inappropriate references to the Feldenkrais method of somatic education in OBMT materials, specifically in a handbook of theirs for applicants. What I think is actually most important for me to say today is what I was going to say next. The AMTA has given solid support to incorporating language of exempting Feldenkrais practitioners and practitioners of other modalities in massage statutes throughout the country. And through our common membership in the Federation of Therapeutic Massage, Bodywork, and Somatic Practice Organizations, the practice of the Feldenkrais method is now exempted in massage statutes in 15 states, including Washington and the District of Columbia, and 3 more states pending with the support of massage organizations. Always through a coalition process, which the American Massage Therapy Association nationally supports. So the Feldenkrais Guild has a great deal of experience of working with people like Bowen Workers and Polarity. Polarity is a very strong member of the Federation, which has been around since 1994. We've been working on these things and getting better and better. And it's really helpful to the legislatures because then we can come to them with something that everybody agrees to.
Okay. We're going to have to move it along.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak and participate in the legislative process. I brought packets, including our testimony, informational brochure, report on regulatory status, and letters supporting exemption. I was also asked by Dr. Renee Stringham to read her testimony.
We have it.
Is that possible? I wouldn't have any comments.
No,
on
we can read it.
You have it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, because we have others to testify. Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Morset and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the honor and privilege of being here today. My name is Deborah Skell. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I'm completing the training in the Feldenkrais method, and I am completing my last year of training. I actually joined a training a year after it commenced, and the guild requirements are very inflexible about what the training involves, and I am now completing that training by going to Amsterdam 4 times this year to take the time that I missed in the beginning of the training that I participated in the States. In the course of that training, has come to my attention that in both Germany and Switzerland, Feldenkrais is widely recognized and not as part of the massage community. I'm here to add my voice to the support of these bills and request for the that Feldenkrais be added as an amendment to the exemptions being given for Bowen and for polarities for the reasons given that it avoids the inappropriate regulation of this method and that it clarifies the status. And so I would like to, I'm going as fast as I can, and I hope I'm making sense. This is my first time testifying as well. So I'm open to any questions, but I am passionate about the need to differentiate this method. It is a very powerful healing modality. It's about learning how you learn to do what you do and doing it in a more effective way. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond to them. If not...
So you go to Amsterdam 4 times a year?
This year, yes.
To complete your training?
Mm-hmm.
In which one?
In Feldenkrais.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But you signed up for both... You signed both sheets, and so you're supportive of both.
Supportive of both bills because I've not heard of the Bowen method before. There are similarities in that it is working on a neuromuscular level, and it's allowing the body to self-regulate in a way that Feldenkrais absolutely supports that approach to learning.
So they are similar.
There is a great deal of commonality, and then there are distinctions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Others in favor? Cindy Roberts, would you come up, please? Anne. Is there another person in the room? Yes, come up.
Yes. Polarity?
Yeah. Oh, we're on polarity.
Well, you open them both. You open them both.
They're both open. Okay.
Did you want to hear?
Yeah. Okay, we'll hear. Yeah. And then we'll hear Cindy.
Thank you.
Okay, good. Polarities.
Do you have, I gave you quite a bit of information. You have that available. There is one handout here I'd like you to have because it will give you kind of a stark example of the difference between, say, the massage approach versus the polarity therapy approach, which is... Okay. We are an energetic
Laura,
modality.
Could you get the...
If someone could...
We'll give it to her.
Laura.
Laura, give it to Laura.
To her. Thank you, dear.
She needs to introduce herself.
Yeah, go ahead and introduce
yourself. I know you've... It's been a long morning for all of you, and I will try not to take up a lot of your time and give you a brief summary. Betsy Johnson, actually, I was appreciative of what she...
She needs to introduce herself.
Yeah, introduce yourself.
Certainly. I'll wait.
Your name?
My name is Ann Waters.
Okay.
I operate the Polarity Center of Salem here in Salem, Oregon.
Okay.
And I've been practicing here for 25 years.
Okay.
And it's been a long time coming before you, and I'm very happy to be here. And I thank you very much for your sponsorship, Senator Lauren Jonas Anderson. I really appreciate it. And for all of you being here patiently, hearing all of our testimonies. And hopefully hearing the distinctions between massage and polarity therapy, plus these other modalities.
Okay.
I am a massage therapist also. I am licensed here in the state of Oregon, so I'm very familiar with the massage statutes and what they stand for and what they represent. What would you like to know? Would you like to know what is polarity therapy? Would you like to know what is a session? I can give you a brief synopsis. Where would you like me to go with this? This shows you distinctly, this is an energetic modality. We do not work with the muscular system directly. We work with the nervous system. We work with energetic principles that are Ayurvedic in their basis. And Ayurveda is an ancient Indian medical profession and came out of northern India. Polarity therapy deals with energy fields and currents that exist everywhere in nature. As an example, this is a wonderful chart which I have in my office. In other words, the reflection in nature of earth, water, fire, air, and ether, these particular chakras that are in the body, energetic fields, is reflective of what we experience every day in nature. Now, Ayurveda deals with this in a holistic fashion. All right, we deal with the mind,
the emotional body and the physical body. We are a hands-on modality. We actually, there are no laws or statutes governing polarity if somebody does off-the-body energetic work. But primarily, our organization, the American Polarity Therapy Association, recommends we do hands-on work. We are not here to resurrect the dead and, you know, act as healers in that fashion. We work with scientific principles, physics, actually, very physical laws we work with the human form, and basically work with energetic currents that move through the body based on the Ayurvedic principles. Now, when we do a hands-on session, basically what we're doing is acting like battery cables. We're connecting positive and negative energy fields. We're trying to remove the resistances in those energy fields so the person can come back to balance. We work with central core energy, trying to bring the energies back to the central core so the person get a sense of the real essence of their energy in the body and relax. All of you would like it. After a day here, you would enjoy it. It's very relaxing. It's very gentle. All right. We can work with people with chronic diseases, acute diseases, without interfering. After surgeries, cancer patients, we're working all across the country in different settings right now, and around the world we have centers. Many of the people that do polarity therapy have PhDs, master's degrees, they're doctors, they're nurses, they're also massage therapists. I was interested when this young woman that was supporting Betsy Johnson came up and said there are 136 polarity therapists in the state of Oregon. That was news to me. A lot of the polarity therapists are working under the auspices of, say, different professions. They are not necessarily regulated by the American Polarity Therapy Association, which unfortunately does not protect the profession, massage profession, naturopathic profession.
Are they part of the massage organization?
Pardon me, sir?
In order to practice, do you have to be part of the, do you have to have training in massage?
Right now in the state of Oregon, yes, you
okay.
have to have another license.
Okay.
That is the point. That's why we're seeking exemption.
Yeah, right, okay.
We do not fall under the category of massage at all, actually, except that we touch the body.
Okay. And so you hang out your shingle as a polarity? Do you say anything about massage? Do people come to you because they think you're a massage therapist? Or do they come to you because they know
I actually present myself as a polarity therapist. I call my center the polarity.
Okay, what I'm trying to get at is advertising. Do you use the word massage in your business at all?
I can use both.
You can,
legally.
But do you?
But technically, I don't. I say I'm a polarity therapist.
Okay.
If somebody calls me, though, and they want a massage, I tell them I'm a polarity therapist, and I'm also a licensed massage therapist. If they want to come to me and they want a massage session, I can give them one.
Okay.
Or I can give them a polarity session. Usually, it's a combination. I have many tools in my toolbox now, so I can incorporate many things within the scope of practice of both the professions.
Okay.
But primarily, I want to practice polarity therapy, and that's primarily what I do. It's holistic. We do simple exercises with people. We have dietary principles that are covered by the Ayurvedic approach. It isn't like dietitian. I'm not a formal dietitian. And primarily the body work is what we do.
Now, where do you live, by the way? Where are you from? Are you from Salem?
Yes, I live in Salem.
Okay.
My address is over right here.
Okay. The reason I'm asking that is that we're running out of time and we have one more person who needs to testify. And you can come back, can't you? We'll have another public hearing at some point.
You know, I'm a little hard of hearing, and what happened to me this morning is one of my hearing aids
right
before the meeting,
yeah.
And I didn't bring a battery. So if you can, if I can hear you if you speak up one more
time. Well, we're running out of time, and we have another person to testify, and because you live in Salem, you can come back and testify
again. Yes, I would like
again.
To come back.
Yes, okay. Why don't we do that? And then, Cindy, would you?
That would be great.
I'm sorry.
I'd be happy to let the citizen...
Okay, go ahead then and continue.
We have another
4 to 5 minutes.
Are you Cindy?
Do we have another person?
It's nice to meet you. We've never met,
okay.
So I'm glad to meet you.
Any other sir, did you want to testify?
No.
Okay. Good. So go ahead. You've got another 4 minutes.
Okay, and if you want me to come back...
Go ahead.
I'd be glad to, no problem. All right, great. You raised your voice, and I can hear everything now. I appreciate it. So, yes, I live here in Salem. Any other... Did you have another direction you wanted to take?
Just tell us some more about your practice.
Okay.
Yeah, just tell us more about it.
Well, basically, when I greet a client, we take a two-hour history.
Okay.
Basically, the very first session, I would say formally a one-hour history, and then I give them a session. I want to know their medical history, because energetically that affects the kind of session I'm going to give this person, whether I'm going to work with one chakra or the other, or whether I'm going to do massage or polarity with this person, or a combination. But when it comes to polarity, I want a full medical history. Many times when they call me and I set up a session, I ask them to bring any supplements, medications in a bag so I can see what they're doing. I do not want to work on someone that is saying psychotropic drugs and have them react during the session, and I didn't know that that was the case. Or if they're diabetic, or if they have heart problems, or if they have AIDS, or if they have diabetes, or if they have whatever ailment they have. And so I spend time with the person. This is a time situation, developing a relationship with that person, so there's trust that's developed. All right, then I would proceed with this session. It might be giving them understanding about food, because I am myself a vegetarian and I support organic food and sustainable agriculture. It doesn't mean everybody that comes has to eat organic food, but it means that I work with these principles. I'm healthy for a 64-year-old woman. I take no medications. I don't smoke, drink, da-da-da-da, and have been doing this for 30 years, okay, and happily. So the person, I find out about their food history. I find out about their exercise history. I find out about their medical history. I find out about their emotional history, which is really important. Their relationships. Are they in stable relationships? Are they in an unstable situation? Because that, of course, the mind is really the key to health. If the mind is distorted or aberrated, there's going to be problems within the emotional body. There's going to be problems within the physical body, as you all know. If you're upset, your body gets upset. If you're nervous, your leg can start twitching. I mean, you're not comfortable. So I try to get a full picture of this person in front of me so I can give them a good session. If they're really tense, I may work with their etheric chakra to help them relax. Or if they're suppressed, I may work with their etheric chakra again to help them express themselves. If they're angry, I may work with their fire chakra to pour water on it a little bit and calm them down. I mean, there are different things that one does depending upon the problem. Okay? So that kind of encompasses the session itself in that then the hands-on approach. Now, there are different energetic sessions for each chakra. There are earth sessions, which work with different energy currents in the body. There are water sessions, which work with water, different water energy systems in the body, on up the line. Fire, air, and ether. All right, so there's a variety of different techniques that can be used in the session to bring the person back into balance. I'm using a combination dependent upon the problem. And there's communication consistently with the client. I work to create an atmosphere that's trusting and comfortable for that client. Clothes remain on the body. You do not have to take off your clothes, so there's no disrobing issues. If there is a problem or a complaint, I wanted to deal with that right away. If someone was really having a problem with a practitioner, they could go to the DA if it was sexual. They could go to our board. We have a board. We have an ethics head. We have a board. We have a president. We have our legislative liaison who sent you a lot of information, LaRose Daniels. We have had our organization now formally since the late 70s.
We're going to have to end here because we have a floor session.
Later. Okay.
How long do you generally, over what period of time do you deal with a patient? Is this a lifetime engagement? Is it
for a
crisis? Is it, yeah.
What I do at the end of the first session is we try to determine how many sessions the person will need to overcome what they need to overcome. If I have to refer them for certain things, I will refer them. The first session is usually $120. I charge $75 an hour. After that, usually sessions only last an hour. the first time is 2. So it stays within that parameter. So if you want me to come back, I'd be fine.
Well, we haven't had a chance to finish with these bills, so they will be posted at another time.
Okay.
So, we'll have another hearing. So, okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
thank you for hearing.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
We will close the public hearing on the 2 Senate bills that we were hearing, 171 and...
No, 693
and 717. And unless there's business before the audience, before the committee.
He's got that hammer in his
hand.
No way, we're out of here.
Good.
I won't be.